All right, we'll stop the screen share and we're going to get started. We want to be thoughtful about your time. I'm sure Dr. Blumenthal's got plenty of things to do. Also, the Cole has another event after this.
Okay.
And tonight we're going to talk about the psychology of tshuva. A little bit later tonight, Rabbi Brand and some of the local chazanim are going to be doing a little bit of a sample of Rosh Hashanah davening, because a lot of the shuls here are not going to have that. And so, and attempts not just to help people with tshuva, but to get into the Rosh Hashanah spirit, we're doing that. So that will be later on this YouTube channel. But for the time being, we are really honored and have the tremendous privilege to have Dr. Norman Blumenthal here. I was almost going to say Rabbi, not just because it flows, but because last time you were here, you gave a drasha in shul, you gave a beautiful drasha in Shalosh Shudas. I was blown away, not just by the psychological insights, but by the Torah. And so if I can embarrass you for a minute, Yom Kippur's coming, I can ask Machila for it later on. But Dr. Blumenthal is one of the leading experts in the Jewish world in psychology. He is constantly getting emails and phone calls, people asking him for help and guidance in many, many, many different things. I'll just share some of his more formal credentials and bio. He spends a lot of his time and a lot of his energies, thankfully, in the Kol Elyon in Yeshiva University and in Reitz, an affiliate of Yeshiva University. And he developed some of our most esteemed, most competent young rabbis into well-rounded and impressive young men. he's a clinical psychologist. He's got a practice in Lawrence. Feel free to reach out. We can share that information later on. He's also the Zachter Family Chair of Trauma and Crisis Counseling for OL, where he spends a lot of time on bereavement and crisis response. Whenever anything crazy is going on around the country, around the world, Dr. Blumenthal is usually not far away. Okay. And so I guess is that sufficient? Should I keep going? There's definitely more.
No, more. You know, I don't want people to get disappointed.
Fair enough. I'm sure they won't be disappointed, but in the interest of time, we'll leave it at that.
It's a great honor to be part of this. I have the highest esteem for the Kollel in Chicago and for Rabbi Brand. And now you have Rabbi Goldstein on board, who is also one of our superstars, along with all the other superstars that are there. And it's really a great honor and privilege to be part of this program that's so community oriented. So I'm really happy to be here.
Okay, well, thank you so much. And we'll just, for all of our listeners, I'll point out that this is a conversation between myself and Dr. Blumenthal. And if there are more questions, for those who are capable, you're welcome to reach out to me. We've got we're live streaming on YouTube, and so you can post into the chat any more questions. We'll do our best to get to them. We'll set aside time at the end for any and all of those questions. But for now, let's talk about tshuva and psychology. And I guess this is a question I should have asked before we started, but is this the kind of things that stick together? Is this Jewish idea of tshuva something that works well in a psychological mindset?
I think it's very natural. As psychologists, we're invested in change, and change for the better, obviously. And the process of growing and changing, which perhaps we're dealing more with, let's say, mental illness or trauma or losses, etc. And tshuva is dealing more with your spiritual growth. But both instances, we're dealing with growth, with change, which is one of the biggest undertakings a person can face.
Okay. When I look back at this year, when it's tshuva time, and now we're saying slichos, and we're going to be saying vidoy not so far from now. And so I'm looking back at my year, looking back at what I've done, and it might not be so great. I've made some mistakes. How do I make sure that as I look at my mistakes, I'm not overwhelmed with guilt?
Okay, good question.
Jump in.
Okay, no problem. It's an interesting sort of paradox, and I think it's reflected both in tshuva, even in Sifrei Musar, and in psychology too, which is that you need healthy self-esteem to change or to look at your shortcomings, not as those that define you, but that those that detract from whom you should be. I have a line I use a lot with patients, and I think it's very important, is I tell them, I can't change you. I'm going to make you better at who you are. And so as we say vidui, if you're going to say vidui and say, I'm just a loser, I'm just buried in sin. I'm a Rasha. I'm a bad person. You're not going to improve. If you look at yourself as I have a lot of strengths, I have a lot to offer and to the Jewish community, to myself, to Hashem. And there's certain things that are getting in the way. There's certain lapses that I may have. I'm not everything I can be. That's going to be a lot easier to achieve than when there's self-denigration or self-condemnation. So vidui is important to be accompanied by healthy self-esteem. Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
That's perfect. Is there ever a point where I don't mean to sound somewhat heretical, but is there ever a point where vidui is too much, where I shouldn't run down the rabbit hole for all of the things that went wrong? How do I find that line?
Okay, so I think when it defines you, when it takes over and defines who you are. Look, vidui, it's an interesting thing. To change, you have to have pain. You know, it's very interesting. One of the first things you're taught when you're trained as a therapist and when a patient comes to you is to ask the patient, why are you here now? Why now? You've had depression for 4 years. What's happened now that prompted you to go for therapy? And it's scary to go for therapy. It's scary, like any kind of change. Just like Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur should be scary. It's scary to go for therapy. But why are you happening now? And usually there's some watershed event. Maybe there's something that just happened that really just shook you to the core. And you're in pain. You're suffering. And we change because of pain. So it's no accident that there's an element of pain that we introduce. I mean, the day most associated with change, Yom Kippur, is a day of Inui Nefesh. We put ourselves in pain. We're hungry. We're not wearing shoes. You know, we're in shul all day. So we introduce an element of pain and suffering which prompt us to change. So we should hurt. Tears should flow. I mean, many of us are not at that level, but that should be. We should be in pain as we say vidui, but we shouldn't allow, it shouldn't come to the point where there's what we call yayish, where there's hopelessness, where there's despair. And sometimes we have to almost sort of build ourselves up so we can face the pain of areas in which we're lacking.
That's so interesting, Matt. Maybe for some people, the avoda of Elul is actually to build themselves up to a place where they can really look back. Okay, all right.
Yeah. And I think that's legitimate. You know, where it takes a very special person to identify his faults or her faults and to say, I'm going to change them. That's an exceptional person. So it's a paradox. But we need to feel bad about ourselves with the backdrop of feeling impressed with ourselves that we're doing this.
Well, so you point out that, it takes a big person to be able to change. If you look at the Rambam, we're Wayu Jews, and
right.
This time of year lives in the Rambam and his Hilchos Tshuva and his laws of repentance. He says that everyone's supposed to change. Everyone's supposed to get better. So do we think that his expectation is that we're all exceptional?
I think so. Yeah. I think so. I think it's a very, first of all, Tshuva is an amazing gift. It's a gift from Hashem. It's the prospect of growth and change, that we're not stuck. We can be 119 and we're still going to shul and improving and growing. This is a wonderful gift, and I think it's a wonderful message. And I think it's part and parcel of how of mental health services and obviously Lahavdil Tshuva. So it is a wonderful experience, and I do believe that it implicit is even the liturgy will often talk about how the greatness of the people, of our people, that we can grow and change and become better.
That's beautiful. Well, so okay, I'm in. I'm ready. I'm big enough that I am ready to change. How do I do it? How do I make sure that any change, any I'm taking on, is actually going to last, and that next year it's not going to be the same conversation?
Right.
I don't know. I'm sure you haven't experienced this, but
sure.
The people who open up their Moxer and they see the list of all the things they wanted to work on from 3 years ago, and they look at their list and it's the same list.
Right. There's also the age-old question, which is why on Matzah Yom Kippur in the Maariv, do we have to say Slach Lanu Avinu Ki Chatanu? right? We're free of all sins. And of course, the answer I heard was that we have to ask for mechila for the ma'ariv we just davened. And it's interesting also, even the research, psychological research on New Year's resolutions, how many are actually kept? I don't have the hand research at my fingertips, but I think only like about half are kept like 3 to 6 months after New Year's. So you know, we're not, it's part of the human condition that we don't change. But change is a very interesting concept. For example, there's a concept in mental health, and I want to remain within my area, my skill set.
I'm going to request, I don't know that I have the authority to, but you talk about whatever you want. We're just having a conversation, and it's okay. Anything that comes to mind, you've got beautiful Rav Soloveitchik on complicated Gemaras in Chelek in Second Sanhedrin. You can quote whatever you want.
Wow. Okay. You know, Beryl Wine's famous line: "God save us from rabbis who think they're businessmen and businessmen who think they're rabbis." So I'll be careful. But there's a concept called working through, which is a very interesting concept. Imagine for a second somebody comes to therapy. Let's say again, for some anxiety, for depression, et cetera. And the therapist just very astutely points out to them exactly why they're depressed and exactly why they're anxious and sends them home. And that's the end of it. That's not going to affect change. It might affect some awareness, some insight, not going to affect change. And the reason for that is that if you're going to change, if you're going to change your outlook to life in terms of, let's say, from a depressive one to a more realistically hopeful one, you can't just change it, you have to sort of introduce that change into every aspect of your life. I mean, I figuratively think about it in terms of weaving. You have to weave that change into every asset, weave it into your relationships. You have to weave it into your parenting, weave it into your relationship with your spouse, with your parents, with your friends, with Hashem, with how you work. You know, so every change is not just a matter of saying, okay, I'm not going to do this anymore. But this change that I'm introducing, how does it find its way? How does it get woven into every aspect of my life? And that's work. That requires concentration, thought, and practice. You have to implement it as well. So vidui might be the impetus. It might launch the process, but it doesn't do it alone. It then becomes a process of seeing how in every walk of life, how you can impact and affect this change.
Okay, and if you really want to do a good job, then go to Lawrence, and I hear there's a very good psychologist there.
Right. Thanks for the plug.
You got a lot of our audience is in Chicago, so that would really be impressive. Okay. All right, wonderful. So I guess to shift gears a little bit, part of the process, and jumping ahead after Rosh Hashanah, part of the process of tshuva is to realize that I've wronged someone else and I'm going to ask for mechila, I'm going to ask for forgiveness.
Right.
And that's an uncomfortable experience for a lot of people. Many rabbis have commented, this isn't me, I'm just echoing what everyone says, that oftentimes the people that we're not asking for forgiveness are the ones who most need our forgiveness. Right. And if I'm going to all my friends and everyone's like, yeah, that's probably not the goal. But it is hard to ask to apologize for things we've done wrong. Can you give any guidance or insight into how to do that?
Right. That's a great question. You know something? I think it also reflects, if I can go a little bit on the soapbox, one of my critiques of our community today, which is that I think we have placed a disproportionate emphasis on Bein Adam L'Makom to the expense of Bein Adam L'Chaveiro. We think about how much of our education is focused on meticulous observance of mitzvahs, which is great. I mean, we have levels of observance today maybe we've never had before. But do we give the same emphasis to our relationship with our fellow man? I mean, I was once speaking to a group of principals, and I asked them, if you had a principals of a high school, I said, if you had a kid in your high school, and a parent called you up and said every day he's coming home, he's riding on his bicycle, he's stopping at McDonald's having a cheeseburger, what would be your response? And suppose another parent calls up at another kid and says, he's teasing another child, he's insulting another child. Would you take it with the same gravity? And I don't want to say, I'm hoping they would have said yes, but it's, I don't have to tell you what the Gemara says about embarrassing people, about malbim panei chavercha barabim. It's the gravity with which the Chazal attached to it is not comparable even to, I think, anything maybe short, maybe I should have a vote czar or something like that, but in Beinodam Lamakam. So
right.
I'm sorry?
And you're probably dealing with the aftermath of all those things.
Yes, yes. And it's very interesting how hard it is to forgive and how we cling, and I talk about myself as well, how we cling to grudges. And you might ask, why? So what? So the person did something to you. Like, why would it be so hard, first of all, to ask for forgiveness, you know, to admit to the fact that you so wronged somebody and to let go of the grudge and to forgive the person. And I think we have to look at it almost from, semi-evolutionary perspective. You know, our survival and our capacity to be safe depended on trusting others. You know, it still does to today, till today. Our ability to, if you will, herd, work together, ensures our safety. For example, there's a lot of studies, I don't want to bore the psychological, a lot of studies show that if somebody feels threatened, that if somebody feels in danger, they will seek out other people for safety. Actually, one of my favorite studies, which I'm quoting a lot now with the COVID situation, was the study on climbing the hill, where they took a group of college students and they gave them a very heavy backpack and they took them to a very steep hill. And they gave them $10, whatever. That's why we love studying college students. For $10, they'll do anything. But we took them a very steep hill and they said, we want you to climb this hill with this very heavy backpack. And before you climb it, we want you to estimate how hard it is. And when you get to the top, we want you to tell us how hard it was. The only difference was one group climbed the hill with a friend and the other one climbed it alone. And pretty consistently, the people who climbed the hill with a friend estimated the hill as less steep, both before and after, than the ones who were climbing it alone. So we need other people. So when our fellow man betray us or hurt us, and especially if it's somebody whom we trusted and we relied on, then the person proved to be somehow our detractor, it really threatens our very existence. It's almost as if we've been threatened with violence or something like that. So we hold on to that grudge for dear life. And it's very hard to let go. And we have to when we're appropriately asked. And by the way, sometimes we have to recognize as well that forgiving doesn't mean you have to become super duper buddies again. You know, you can forgive someone, you can be civil with them. You don't have to be as close. This is important, by the way, with marriages that dissolve, that the marriage with its divorce. It doesn't mean you have to turn the person to enemy. You're not going to be obviously as close as you were before. You'll have a sort of civil business relationship with the ex-spouse. But it's very hard. And it goes to the core of our sense of safety and dependability in the world, how much we rely on other people. So I don't want to minimize it. It is very difficult. It's a huge challenge. And that needs to be part of our LL preparation and part of our education as well, that we have to take that chance if somebody genuinely comes and asks us for forgiveness.
Yeah. Okay, well.
Too much or am I? No, okay.
I find that I did study psychology, although I don't. It's not that I'm doing much with it. Thankfully, I'm able to teach a lot. But I feel like I'm back in a classroom. You know, one of the things that you did, one of the places we've overlapped is that while you trained their up and coming rabbis, not you know the Kol Elyon where Rabbi Goldstein and Rabbi Kraft and Rabbi Brand came from, and they've got a lot of attention. But even for you know us regular guys, Friday mornings I spend with you, and I feel like I'm back in class. It's wonderful. But then I have to get back in and focus again.
Right. I'm sparing you the jokes.
Yeah. Right. Okay. So that's in regards to asking somebody for forgiveness or someone being able to forgive us. What happens if, I get to the point where I'm comfortable enough and secure enough that I can come and ask you for forgiveness, but you're not ready to forgive me?
Mm-hmm.
Putting aside whatever responsibilities or not responsibilities and asking three times, if I got to the point and I'm vulnerable, as you pointed out, to ask for forgiveness and someone says no, now what do I do?
So understand that let's say you're asking me, obviously it's theoretical because I bear no grudge against you, but I don't know what kind of grade I gave you in Pespetos, like something, but let's say you want to ask me for forgiveness. We're two, right? You've had time to work it up, time to think it over, get ready. You come to me, I might not have had the same preparation. And again, as I said, this goes to the core. It's very hard. Now, I think it's entirely possible that the person who's been asked may not be ready yet. And I think that's, and I think it's better to genuinely forgive than to make believe you forgive when you haven't. I think it's okay to say, you know something, this, I appreciate what you're doing. I need to work on this. I need to work on myself because this is not easy. And I think that's an honest answer. And I don't think it's a rejection of what the person, of the overture that the person made, but I think it's being human. We're hurt. We're human beings. We're not malachim. And as I said, sometimes other people, the way other people hurt us is, in fact, and I don't have to tell you, they're, you know, somebody punches you, it hurts. It doesn't hurt as much as betrayal. It doesn't hurt as much as being publicly humiliated. It doesn't hurt as much as being insulted or being disappointed with. I mean, these things really hurt. And if you're the one who has to do the forgiving, it's work. You have to really work on yourself. And you, I think it's okay to say, this is, you know, I appreciate it, but I'm not ready yet. I need time. I'm gonna try.
Okay, that's probably part of the, not motivation for the halakha, but that's probably, it's maybe the taste, the ta'am of the halakha, that you're supposed to ask three times,
right,
in three different places, and you're not just, you know, right after Rosh Hashanah, and then right before Shabbat Shuvah, and then right on Erev Yom Kippur.
Right. So, no, it's hard. It's very, very hard. Okay. And I've had sessions with people who have been betrayed and hurt by people whom they trusted. It's heart-wrenching. It's very, very difficult. And then to go around and make yourself vulnerable again, it takes work, but you got to do it. That's what we're about.
Okay. Well, so on that sadness, that vulnerability, maybe, where this isn't a normal Rosh Hashanah by far. And so there are a lot of pieces to it. Maybe I'll just ask you to share some thoughts on a COVID Rosh Hashanah, but for the time being, something that came up recently is that whether it's Tashlich or it's shofar blowing or it's just shul, we're likely to see a lot of people that we haven't seen in a long time. And that has its own things to explore. But in particular, there have been unfortunately many, many losses in our community, Rachmana Litzlan. And so what happens if I know someone who lost a parent, a grandparent, somebody, and I wasn't able to go to Shiva, or maybe I did, but it didn't really work out. And now I'm seeing them for the first time. In your, I guess, expert opinion, what do I do now? I want to say hello. I also want to recognize that they've lost somebody. It's been a long time. I don't want to bring down their yontiv by reminding them of how terrible things were. What can I do?
Great question. You know, there's a term that I hate, which is called getting over it. You don't get over a loss. The loss of a loved one, you never get over. There is such a thing as nechama. I think it's beyond the scope of what we can talk about now to sort of define nechama. But it, just in essence, nechama means doesn't getting over the loss, like not feeling the loss anymore. Nechama means integrating the loss into your understanding of yourself and the world, of sort of getting mastery over the loss, but not getting over it. And nobody ever gets over a loss, even an elderly grandparent. You know, one of the things that has been very interesting, we've learned so much from this crisis. I mean, it's a pity that we need crises to learn, but I know even our crisis team I feel like the breadth of my understanding of trauma and loss has grown so much from this. But the, you know, one of the things we've become very acutely aware of, and you alluded to it, is grandparent loss. You think, all right, it's a grandparent, it's an older person, you know, that's what's supposed to happen. But first of all, grandparents today are like, you know, very youthful. You know, it's not, they're not like the Alta Bobby and Zadie from Europe. They're very Kanainahara. We have some very young grandparents. But even putting that aside, grandparents have a very special place in our lives. They have a role. They're not just these cute little old people who we patronize. They represent the unadulterated love. You know, a parent has to disappoint. The grandparent doesn't. And that's very special for children to have. In fact, I will tell you personally, having grown up as a child of a Holocaust survivor and in a community where most of our parents were survivors or immigrants, where there were very few grandparents, I've come to appreciate how important, what a void there is when there aren't grandparents. Grandparents also represent that connection to the past, which is so important. I mean, there's an amazing body of research now in psychology about ancestry and how people who have that connection with their past, who have that awareness of where they come from and their family stories and narratives, function better, have better resilience, function with anxiety better and with depression better. So it's they're very important. And someone who lost a grandparent lost someone very important, and there's a void in their lives. And they don't need it explained away. First of all, they don't need pity. No puppy eyes. Nobody wants to be pitied. As pity means I'm up here and you're down here. They don't want to be pitied. And they don't need explanations, and they don't need something to try to get rid of their pain. They need validation and recognition and a fact that you understand that this has been a hard year for them, and that their loved one's missing. And if you can just convey that, you know, I've been thinking a lot about you. I love to hear about your grandfather some more. I've heard a few things. I really, when we have a chance and we can meet more, we can talk more, I want to hear more about him. These are the kind of things that are comforting. And sometimes all it is just showing your affection and love. Just walking over to them and saying, I've been thinking about you a lot. You can't give them a hug nowadays, but give them a virtual hug, you know. But in ways to show that they're cared for and you're thinking about them and you're recognizing that there's been such a profound loss. And not only has there been a profound loss, and this is another part that has been so difficult, that hasn't even been able to, that many people haven't been able to have the normal parting. The normal avaya, even just visiting in the hospital, or the normal shiva, and it's a huge deprivation, and it is a wonderful opportunity. I don't think it detracts from yomtiv. We're not trying to make them sad. It's validating their experience and making it clear that you're thinking about them and care about them.
Not that anyone cares, but I can definitely say, having lost a few grandparents, unfortunately, the past few years, that the unadulterated love is something that jumped out at every one of the levies and all the discussions that resonates very deeply. And okay, thank you. I guess in the discussion of, you know, lost grandparents and lost family members, there's a lot of discussion about the putum that we're saying. I don't know what's going on where you're davening. I can tell you in Chicago. There are a lot of putum that we're not saying, but one put that we are keeping is unasana tokif. Is the tefillah talks about the din, the judgment that's taking place in these days. And there are a lot of jokes about how, you know, we go through, you know, Rosh Hashanah Yikasevu, V'yom Som Kippur Yikasemun, and it goes, you know, the list of all the different ways that somebody could pass away. And we I guess jadedly used to joke, you know, if you were to pick one, which one would it be? The one to pick is pestilence, because that's some like biblical one that doesn't exist anymore, right? Sounds like it. Who knew? And so if I'm in shul and it's coming and I've dealt with something, or maybe I definitely haven't gotten over it, as you said. Can you give a recommendation? And what do I do? Should I stay there? Should I listen to it and go through? Should I step out?
Well, I'll tell you two stories, if you will.
Please, yes.
One was someone that, again, I'm going to say cryptically, I don't want people, you know, don't necessarily want to know, but someone who unfortunately lost a child under very tragic circumstances. And the first, I think it was the Yom Kippur afterwards, when the Chazan was saying the Sana Tokef, and he said, mi bi'ito, mi lo bi'ito, who in the normal time and not the normal time, he began to cry. And the Chazan, with great sensitivity, stopped. And he sat, and the whole shul was quiet while he cried for 10 minutes straight. And then they went on davening. And afterwards, he said, many of the members of the shul came over and thanked him how much he enhanced their davening. I will tell you personally, and this is a somewhat personal matter, but I guess I can more readily share a personal issue. People ask me how I can handle dealing with trauma and loss all year with terrible circumstances. And there are many ways, and I have many answers, but one of them is what I look forward to personally is Nesana Tokef on Yom Kippur. I bury myself in my talis, and as the Chazan is davening, I see all the tragedies. I see all the losses. I see the children that died, the young parents, that died, the traumas that people had gone through, and they're walking in front of me, and I have a delicious cry, and it's tremendously cathartic. I look forward to it. I literally look forward. It carries me through the year. So especially this year, when we, I mean, who would have imagined last year that this is where we'd be now? And if we need that humbling, if we need to sort of prostrate ourselves before Hashem and say, we're totally at your mercy. With all the technology we have and with all the scientific advancement, we're so at your mercy. As one of my friends put it, Hashem just pulled the plug on the world. You know, it's like, you know, if we need to have that experience, and it's a wonderful experience. It's not painful. As I said, it's cathartic. And with the backdrop of the beautiful melodic versions that Chazanim have developed for the, I can't think of a more beautiful or heightened spiritual experience that is, as I said, healthy. For me, it is. It really carries me through the year.
Oh, thank you for sharing. I'll echo what I've heard you say on more than one occasion, that I'm so glad that, you know, through all the trauma, you're still so sensitive to it.
Well, I always tell my wife, the day I get a call and I can go without any hesitation, then I have to retire. I have to hate it. I have to be in pain, or else I'm not capturing what's happening. So I'm worried about becoming jaded. And if that does happen, I'm going to be turning down invitations to speak on YouTube for the Kol Ol Mitzion. You know, it's okay. But I hope that doesn't happen.
Okay. Well, I don't know if this is brighter or not, but you know, you spend a lot of time working with rabbis. Can you maybe give us an insight into what the rabbis' experience these days is? I don't know if you have people reaching out to you, but can you give us an insight, just, you know, because it's interesting, but also maybe even, you know, as congregants, is there something that we can do to help? If even if I need something from my rabbi, is there something I can do for him, for his family?
Oh, that's a very good, you know, something, it's interesting that sometimes we have to remind ourselves that rabbis are human beings too. You know, we expect them to be so, first of all, to do everything, and to be superhuman, and they make mistakes, and they have vulnerabilities, and thank God for that, because it's through our, again, this takes us back to the whole tshuva process. It's, you know, many years I supervised residents and interns at a psychiatric hospital, and training them in therapy, and the first week of July, when they'd first come on, you know, I'd have to meet with them, and please, you know, put your foot in your mouth. Because I found over the years that the trainees who were so afraid to make mistakes, they didn't do anything good, they didn't do anything bad, they were too scared. But those who, of the young men that we are training and bringing to the communities, and I think your call is an amazing example of that. And they are terrific. And I think we have to, you know, a thank you. I appreciate that. You're looking tired, Rabbi. When's your vacation coming up? It's, you know, are important as well. They're human beings.
Okay. All right. Well, I can definitely say that if any of our rabbis are doing well, it's in no small part to the help that you provided. So I'll remind people that those who are interested can send in questions. I've gotten a couple that we've already sort of, you know, thrown in.
Okay.
But you're welcome to either send them to me or to post them on YouTube. And so you and I have had a few conversations, and before you got involved in trauma and bereavement, you actually worked a lot of times with what you might call at risk or off the derrick, kids.
Right.
So if this time of year, we're all sort of feeling like a little bit like we're off the derech. But if someone is really struggling, whether it's because of the events of this past year or not, I would imagine that, you know, this is a time when people are coming to shul. You know, whether someone was at shul or not in shul, this is when everyone's being encouraged. If there's someone who's not feeling connected, is there a healthy way to deal with that, both internally and maybe from a family perspective?
So it's a very interesting how you say that they don't feel connected. I want to tell you a very interesting experience with these kids. Now we're talking about back in the 90s. It was a different kind of crew than it is today. But a lot of these kids, it was almost like an epidemic. It was another kind of pandemic. A lot of kids who were, you know, dressing inappropriately, body piercings, drugs and things like that. And I remember once there was a community conversation about what's going on in the community, and somebody was complaining about how, you know, you can't go in Saturday Matzah Shabbos to a kosher pizza shop when these guys are hanging around smoking cigarettes, you know, hanging out with girls, whatever, you know, they're all kind of inappropriate behavior. And someone said to them, but they're in the kosher pizza shops. They're not in Domino's. They're not in Pizza Hut. They're in Sabra's, they're in David's, they're in Jerusalem Pizza, acting up like this. And I think it very much captures, you know, my father, Lava Shalom, had a joke he loved about this Jewish guy who wanted to get into one of these waspy country clubs. So he finally gets admitted and he sees he's the only Jew there. He's feeling very self-conscious. Suddenly there's an announcement, well, Mr. Tannenbaum, will please come to the office. And he sees a guy getting up and going to the office. So afterwards, he comes up to him and says, excuse me, Mr. Tannenbaum? And he said, yeah. So I just want to introduce myself. My name is Jack Schwartz, and I'm glad to see a fellow Jew here. And the guy says, Jew? He said, I'm Episcopalian. My wife's Episcopalian, and my parents are Episcopalian, and my wife's parents are Episcopalian, and even my grandfather, Olav Shalom, was Episcopalian. You know, it's the connection's there. The connection is powerful. And I don't think we lose it that quickly. Do we feel disillusioned? Do we feel hurt? Do we feel inadequate to keep up with all these demands in terms of mitzvahs and sacrifices? Yes, that can happen. It doesn't happen to a lot of these kids. But it's interesting. I have to say that in some respects, that's easier than what most of us experience. Because if you get that global disillusionment and you're ready to sort of abandon halachic observance or something like that, it's almost easier to come back than when you feel like you're part of the halachic community, but you're lacking in a particular area. I actually saw, I'm sure you're familiar with it, a Rama, which said that safek chait is harder than a vaday chait. And the korban, asham batalu, is a more expensive korban than the asham itself, you know, when you're not sure. And so when you are, so if you have a total disconnection and then come, it's almost easier to sort of come back and re-embrace. But when you have that general connection, but you're just missing this area here, or you're not sure, you know, or you're not sure what everything is supposed to be. That's hard, in some respects harder and more difficult. It's almost like, again, if I want to compare it in therapy, a lot of people like addiction work because the growth and the success is very clear. You were drinking, you're not drinking. You know, you were doing drugs, you're not doing drugs. You're gambling, you're not gambling. But when you're dealing with some of the more subtle types of psychiatric ailments like depression, so did you go from being depressed to just sensitive? Did you, you know, are you really now have a more sanguine approach to life, or is it still some of the gloom and doom is still haunting you? It's harder to quantify. So I think some respects, those of us on the derech have a harder time with tshuva than those who may be temporarily off.
Very interesting. This is a time that we could really use some, because like, is any chance you could share a story or two of you know, people who have tried to change, to get better, whether off the derech, on the derech, in some capacity, some story you could share?
Let me try. I have to be careful not to divulge anything. Let me think if a story jumps to me that's sufficiently disguised. I'm gonna pass on that. Some stories are crossing my mind, but I don't want to. I'll just tell you this, that, and maybe I can tie it in. You know, we talk about the challenge and how hard it is to change. I think we also have to identify the exaltation when you're not where you, in fact, I have a very beautiful story to tell you. I do have a story to tell you. The exaltation of having achieved being in a different place. This is not quite about change, but I think it's a story that really captures what happens in therapy and what happens in tshuva as well. My mother was a survivor of 7 concentration camps. And she once told me when she realized that she was liberated. And it was in actuality a year and a half after her actual liberation. She was liberated from Bergen-Belsen in April 1945. And as many of you may know, Sweden took in many of the refugees and allowed them to stay for, actually, they, my mother says they were concierging when they're leaving, so they didn't want them to stay, but they took them in. And my mother was this 21-year-old who had, since the age of 14, lived in various ways under Nazi occupation. And there was a young male refugee there in Sweden who took a liking to her, and he asked her out on a date. And it was the first date of her life. And he took her to a concert. And they're sitting there talking, everything's fine. Suddenly there's a commotion, and everybody's looking towards the back of the room. And it seems it was the custom in Sweden that the musicians would wear uniforms and march into the concert hall. And she looks to the back, and sure enough, there are these blonde-haired, blue-eyed Aryans in uniforms marching. And she said she went right back to the camps. You know, she heard the dogs barking and the screaming in German and the shooting. And remembers her date trying to get her attention. It was like he was miles away. And then, to her utter amazement and sheer joy, these alleged Nazis sat down and played music. And she realized she was liberated. A year and a half after liberation. Now, that's a very, rather dramatic story for someone who had a very dramatic life. But there is that exhilaration. That first time when your spouse does something that would have elicited a very angry response from you, and you catch yourself and you respond in a civil way. That's a wonderful experience. Or the first time that you were going to panic over some minor mishap, and you sort of catch yourself and you say, not a big deal. Or the first time you were just turning to someone just to share some Lashon Hara, and suddenly you say, wait a minute, I did vidui about that. I'm not going to say it. That's an exhilarating experience. And it's an amazing, and that's really when you see it, when you're back in the old situation, but your response is different. And so I think that it's important to remember for all of us, myself and for all of us, that achieving tshuva and change and growth is a huge struggle. It's the hardest thing you do. But when you get there, it's a wonderful place to be.
That description, first of all, thank you for sharing that story. But that description sounds a lot like what the way the Rambam explains of what tshuva looks like, you know, when you're in the exact same situation and you don't succumb. That's wonderful. That's beautiful. Yeah. So we only have a couple minutes left. We talked a lot about Rosh Hashanah, COVID Rosh Hashanah, but are there any other thoughts maybe that you could or would share with us before we go?
So I'll tell you, you know, I've been thinking a lot also about, you know, since March, I've dealt with little else but the COVID and the crisis and all the webinars and calls we've had dealing, groups we've run. I mean, in Ohel we ran six groups for people who lost loved ones to go, two for teenagers, and we ran two groups for widows and one for widowers, and we ran four groups for adults who lost. I mean, it's been a whirlwind of an experience these past few months. And as I face Rosh Hashanah and I faced in the year, I was thinking to myself that in some respects, I'm more worried about when COVID's going to be over than while we're in COVID. Because, and I think this again speaks to what we're talking about, are we going to just go back to the way we were? Are we going to look at this, I don't know how long it's going to be, not much longer, but are we going to look at this COVID crisis, just a bump in the road, and let's be who we were? Or this is a message. This is a text message from Hashem. And are we going to be different? Are we going to extract lessons? Because that's our way of dealing with crises and with setbacks. We grow from them. Just as I said, pain is growth, and we're in a lot of pain. It always strikes me, and one of the things that I struggle with this COVID thing personally, is why would Hashem give us a nisayon that prevents us from davening, prevents us from having full tefillos, having to cut out piyutim? Isn't that what he wants from us? What's the message? And I mean, I have my own thoughts, which I don't know if I should share. But you know, when we can take off the masks, when we can sit next to each other again, when we can sing freely without any kind of worries, when we can blow the shofar without having to put plexiglass around the baltokeya and covers over the, I mean, when we go back, are we just going to go back, or are we going to learn from this, and are we going to extract lessons? I'm grappling with this, and I invite all of you to grapple with it as well. And my hope is that this will be over soon, and we're going to come back somehow improved, somehow different, but somehow with a better and more exalted perspective than we had before. And that's my hope, and that's my thoughts about the COVID.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much. It's been wonderful. I would have paid to do this, but unfortunately, I have the best job in the whole world, so I get to do this, and we get to share with other people. But thank you for your insights, your wisdom, and for everything that you've been doing to support the Jewish community over these past 6 months.
Thank you. Thank you. And Hatzlacha to the Kollel, please. I'm telling everybody in Chicago, hold your head up high that you have such an institution. It's really to your credit and to your benefit.
All right. Okay. And I'll just conclude before wishing you a ksuva v'chasima tova with a mazel tov. You made a wedding.
Yes, this past week. Yes. Right. Yes. Thank you.
I think we just finished Shemar Brachos. And right. So I don't know if we need to thank your wife for you know, letting you stay out of the kitchen getting ready for Rosh Hashanah, or if she should thank us because you're not in the way.
I think it's the latter. I think it's
a... Okay. Well, wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Okay.
Thank you so very much.
Okay.
Have a wonderful evening.
You too. Bye-bye.